Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Ben Goldfarb. He's an independent environmental journalist and fiction writer. He's the author of Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter, Chelsea Green Publishing, which the Washington Post called a masterpiece of a treatise on the natural world. He covers wildlife conservation, marine science, and public lands management, but he'll tackle any story with an environmental bent and some without. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks for having me, Derek. I appreciate it.
So, who are beavers?
It's a great question. Beavers are these extraordinary landscape scale agents of transformation. They're, you know, of course, they're rodents, and they build dams. We all know that. And those dams, which create ponds and wetlands, turn out to be tremendously important for every member, or virtually every member, of the biological community. You know, from the moose that cool off in them, to the amphibians, frogs and salamanders that breed in them, to the juvenile fish that shelter in them, to the waterfowl that nest around them. Beavers turn out to be this essential pillar of so many ecological communities. So I think that's first and foremost who beavers are, is this keystone species responsible for supporting so much other life in North America and Europe.
So before we go on, let's talk about their range, their natural range, not introduced range yet.
Yeah.
To where are beavers natural, and what is their, and how many species are there?
Yeah. So there are two species of beavers. There's Castor canadensis, which is the North American beaver, and then there's Castor fiber, which is the Eurasian beaver. They're very closely related. They don't interbreed. They can't interbreed, but they are sort of visually indistinguishable for most people. So the North American beaver, historically the range was basically northern Mexico to the tundra line, essentially. I mean, every state in the continental United States and really nearly the entirety of Canada had beavers, and they were incredibly abundant. And over in Europe, again, beavers covered really nearly the entirety of the European continent and most of Asia as well. There were beavers as far east as the Korean Peninsula historically, which most people don't realize. So this was once an extraordinarily abundant animal, and we're gradually getting back to that point.
So again, before we go to what happened at conquest, can you tell me the average size of a beaver, and how big is a huge one? And also, I've heard they run in a variety of colors.
Yeah. So, it's a typical adult beaver is probably going to be 50 to 60 pounds. You'll see 70 pounders is not unusual, which I think is much bigger than most people realize. You know, I think when most people see beavers, they just see a head moving across the water at twilight, you know, with the rest of the body submerged. And you don't quite realize that these are really some very hefty, powerful animals. They weigh as much as, as many decent-sized domestic dogs. They do come in a variety of colors. That you'll see beavers that are as light as balsa wood, and as dark chocolate. So they definitely come in this sort of range of colors within the general brown spectrum.
And how long do they normally live, and who eats them?
Yeah, 12. So in the wild, 12 to 15 years would be a pretty old beaver. They're eaten by all kinds of large carnivores. Wolves love beavers, and in some places, beavers are actually the majority of wolf summertime diets, which I think that people don't really realize just how what an important food staple beavers are for wolves in places where wolves and beavers co-occur. Bears, grizzly and black bears both eat beavers. Cougars love beavers. I saw a picture recently of a lynx that had killed a beaver, which was pretty impressive. As coyotes occupy more and more of the North American landmass, they've become a really significant beaver predator as well. So, one biologist described beavers to me as a fat, slow, smelly package of meat. So there's certainly a lot out there that preys on them.
And do they like sneak up on them when they're on the shore, basically? Because I'm guessing that's that in the pond they're much more impervious to predators.
Yeah, it's a really good question. There's a PhD student named Tom Gable who's studying this right now. How do predators, especially wolves, kill beavers? And there was really an amazing. He actually shot some amazing footage of a wolf. So he kind of came across this wolf that was standing in the middle of a logging road around Voyageurs National Park in Minnesota, and the wolf was sort of staring intently at a stream. And 15 minutes or so went by, and then suddenly the wolf lunged into the stream. Came back out on the road with a beaver in its jaws, and then kind of dropped the beaver on the road, still alive. And the two animals sort of faced off for a few minutes, and finally the wolf killed the beaver. So that was a pretty cool example of wolves. Clearly this wolf had staked out this stream, knew that beavers were moving back and forth across it, set up this very patient ambush, and nabbed one. So you also hear about bears that actually tear into beaver lodges. So predators have all kinds of interesting strategies for hunting these guys, because they are challenging prey in some respects, because of course they build these dams to create these ponds and wetlands so that they can be safe. The pond is a pretty good stronghold, so they're not always the easiest animal to hunt. But predators have clearly evolved all kinds of strategies for eating these delectable rodents.
One last question before we go to what happened when Europeans came to this continent, which is something I've always wondered, is how is it that concrete dams, of course, harm anadromous fish, and we don't need to make that case because it's so obvious, but beaver dams, how do anadromous fish deal with beaver dams?
Yeah, it's a good question. And certainly there are definitely fish biologists out there who dislike beavers or there are programs out there that involve destroying beaver dams or and even killing beavers to promote anadromous fish passage. And to me that's ridiculous. So beaver dams, of course, we know that they're not impermeable, right? Unlike a concrete dam, there's plenty of water moving through a beaver dam, and fish are often capable of actually wriggling through the dam itself, through the kind of the woody framework of the dam. I know scientists who have actually observed that in action. Fish are capable of jumping beaver dams at certain beaver dams. That's definitely been documented. And then they can also swim around beaver dams. Oftentimes in a beaver stream, you'll have this kind of multi-threaded, multi-channel stream where maybe one channel is impounded by a beaver dam, but there are other side channels that circumnavigate it. So to me, it's true that at very low water, beaver dams can pose temporary barriers to fish passage, but ultimately, fish are able to surmount these things without too much trouble. There's one study in Oregon that documented steelhead passing more than 200 beaver dams, individual steelhead crossing a couple hundred beaver dams. So they clearly figure out ways around them. And in fact, we know quite conclusively that beaver dams and the kind of the fantastic ponds, wetlands, side channels, backwaters that they create are incredible juvenile salmon habitat. That beaver occupancy and salmon production have been very closely linked, and we know that beavers are great for fish. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of fish-related beaver opposition out there, but increasingly, agencies like the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration are adopting or promoting beaver restoration as a tool for salmon recovery, because they create such great salmon habitat.
Yeah, the opposition, frankly, seems kind of absurd to me. They evolved together, and they've been getting along for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years.
Yeah, the bumper sticker I really like says "Beavers taught salmon to jump," which I think is
Oh, I
kind of
love that.
captures the co-evolutionary relationship there.
So I know I've said this a half dozen times, but yeah, one more question before we go to the conquest, which
Sure.
is, what would be an example? There's a salmon-bearing stream 30 yards from where I'm sitting, and it has beaver on it further down, and I'm always sort of daydreaming that they're going to move their way up. So first question is, what are the smallest streams that beavers ever live on? This stream is maybe 5 feet wide and 2 feet deep. And then also, what is the larger we don't have to be the world record, but the sort of larger end of beaver dams. How big are beaver dams from tiniest to small to largest?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the world's, well, I'll tell you that the largest beaver dam ever recorded is in Alberta, and that's a half mile long or so, and it is visible from space. So these things can be pretty massive. But you know, more typically, I mean, usually a beaver colony will build a primary dam, and then a number of kind of secondary dams. And that primary dam, which sort of does the bulk of the water storage work, is typically, you'll often see that a couple hundred feet is kind of a large primary dam. As for the smallest, I mean, they would, you know, it sounds like that your stream is suitable. I think the kind of their amazing talent, of course, is that they're almost capable of creating water seemingly from nothing. You know, I've heard and seen so many stories of beavers taking these pathetic little seasonal trickles, you know, and by slowing water down and backing it up and sort of just prolonging the residency time of the water. They take these pitiful little streams and turn them into kind of robust perennial flows. So I think that beavers would be okay on your stream. I think that more important than kind of the volume of water is really the gradient of the stream, right? If you've got a very steep stream that water is really rushing down in spring, it's going to be hard for them to build a lasting dam there. So I think that even more important than the volume of the flow is kind of the power of the flow, because dams do wash out, and if the stream is too steep, beavers won't be happy there.
Well, I hope they make it up then, because I live on a coastal plain, so it's the gradient's very low.
Yeah, that sounds like good habitat to me.
So let's get to conquest, and something that both breaks my heart and I think is one of the most important things to do is to recognize who was here before. In Northern California, for example, prior to conquest, you would routinely see if you were by a river, every 15 minutes you'd probably see a grizzly bear. And we know about the flocks of passenger pigeons, so large they darken the sky for days at a time. The flocks of Eskimo curlews. I was reading not very long ago about down by Houston, very early European explorers would see a single pack of wolves that would be several hundred.
Wow.
And you know, we can tell these stories for everywhere. So can you tell some stories about abundance / range / ubiquity of beavers?
Yeah, absolutely. So we don't know exactly how many beavers were in North America, of course, prior to colonization. The best estimate we have is up to 400 million. By 1900, they were down to 100,000 after trapping. So that kind of gives you some numeric sense of how dramatic the destruction was. But I mean, you're right that just, you know, you read these incredible trappers and explorers' accounts of what the land looked like, and it's just incredible to me how dramatically beavers influenced this continent historically. You know, when Lewis and Clark went up the Missouri in Montana, you know, they saw beaver dams in every single tributary as far as the eye could see to the base of the mountains. You know, there were places where they couldn't even really use their canoes in some of these valleys because beavers had so thoroughly dammed and ponded. They had to walk along the ridge lines because the influence of beavers was so great. You know, by that was in 1805. By 1843, John James Audubon went up the Missouri Basin, so the exact same area. And he didn't see a beaver for 2,000 miles. He was looking for beavers to paint, and he couldn't find one. So in just 38 years, you know, we went from having dams in every single tributary as far as you could see to this animal being completely eliminated from this vast watershed, which is pretty incredible. I mean, elsewhere you read about explorers crossing the state of Indiana and not finding a dry place to camp for 100 miles because beavers had so thoroughly ponded and marshed the entire place. You know, there are so many of these stories. So to me, you know, it's one of the really tragic things in a lot of ways about reporting this book and researching the historic influence of this animal is just realizing, how much we lost, you know, and how much important habitat we lost too. You know, we know that wetlands are so critical to sustaining life on this continent. And, you know, we lost hundreds of millions of acres of beaver-built wetlands. You know, we just lost so much open water and wet meadows and just incredibly lush ground. So, you know, I don't think that we really think about, you know, we don't think about beaver trapping in the same terms as we think about the deforestation of the Northeast or, you know, the busting of the Midwestern prairie or placer mining in California. But I think that we should think about beaver trapping in that way as sort of this early seminal environmental catastrophe that must have been so devastating for so many species that are intensely reliant on these fantastic beaver-built habitats.
And what year was the nadir of this, and what was the lowest number about that we know?
Yeah, so probably around 1900, the beaver populations bottomed out at around 100,000. And again, you know, these are just sort of very, very ballpark estimates. But beavers were certainly wiped out of nearly the entirety of the lower 48. There were still some beavers out west, but they were totally gone from the Northeast, Southeast, most of the Midwest, California. You know, really, there were just a handful of pockets of beavers in kind of the Rocky Mountains and the Northwest, and Canada still had some, but. You know, there's no question that well over 99% of North America's beavers were killed during the fur trade.
And what are the numbers now? What has happened since?
Yeah, so now we're sort of a lot of these population estimates are just kind of shots in the dark. But you know, the ones that I've seen are maybe 15 million or so beavers in North America. So you know, it all depends on what your historical baseline is, right? I mean, from one perspective, we went from 100,000 just, you know, barely over a century ago to 15 million. That's, you know, that's really one of the world's greatest wildlife recovery stories. You know, beavers are this incredible success. But of course, if you broaden your lens to, you know, 1491, we're still at a very small percentage of historical beaver occupancy. So, you know, people often ask me if beavers are endangered, and you know, the answer is no. There are plenty of beavers in North America. I'm sure, you know, most listeners have seen a beaver at some point. But you know, it's all about how abundant we want this animal to be. You know, if we want to reap all of the benefits that it's capable of providing us, you know, we have a long way to go in getting back to, you know, what a really beneficial beaver population might be.
So let's go back to the collapse of beaver populations. And were the primary causes the physical trapping, or was it also the introduction or the putting in dams, draining swamps, or was that sort of a synergistic effort?
Yeah, you know, I think that certainly the primary cause was trapping. You know, that beavers, I mean, so beavers mostly trap for their under fur, which trappers often call beaver wool, which is felted into hats, basically. And hats were, you know, sort of all the rage in Europe for a few centuries there, and beaver hats were a very hot commodity. So it was certainly the direct trapping of these animals that wiped them out. But you're right that the draining of wetlands for agriculture and development, you know, certainly made it eliminated lots of beaver habitat and made it harder for them to recover. And I think another really big impact was grazing, was the introduction of domestic livestock. You know, beavers, of course, require riparian or streamside vegetation for food and to build their dams and lodges. And you know, when you've got herds of thousands of cattle sort of grazing unchecked in the stream bed, eating all of that vegetation, it becomes basically impossible for beavers to establish. So I think as you say, it was kind of a synergistic effort where the primary and original cause of the collapse was the direct trapping, but then the draining of these wetlands and the destruction of all of this riparian forage, you know, that was eaten by domestic cattle, made it hard for beavers to recover in many places.
So I mentioned before, I believe, that I grew up in the West. I grew up in Colorado and then lived in Nevada and lived in North Idaho, and now it's Northern California. And the places I've lived have been rural West, which means they're very strongly anti-nature for the most part. And One of the complaints I would hear sort of nature haters throw out against beavers is they kill trees. They kill lots of trees. They'll destroy a forest.
Right.
So can you respond to the notion that beavers are evil forest destroyers, says the guy holding a chainsaw?
Right, exactly. So you definitely hear that a lot. To that I would respond that beavers, yes, they are cutting down trees. Of course, there's no way of getting around that, but they're also producing new trees, right? I mean, beavers are almost like rotational farmers in a lot of ways, right? They cut down trees, they build these dams, they raise not only the level of the pond, but they're also raising the water tables, right? When you look at a beaver pond, you know, of course, there's all of the visible surface water, but there's also lots of water being forced into the ground and being spread out on the floodplain and being stored in aquifers. There's incredible groundwater recharge that you get thanks to beavers, which basically acts as sort of this incredible force of irrigation that is actually stimulating the growth of new willow, aspen, cottonwood elsewhere in the beaver complex. So they're sort of like rotational farmers in that they'll build this complex and they'll cut down willows on one side of the pond, and that will be their forage for a year or two or whatever. But meanwhile, they're by raising water tables, they're creating conditions for the growth of all of these riparian trees on the other side of their complex. So yes, they're cutting down trees, but they're also creating the conditions in which new trees can flourish. It's kind of this really wonderful long-term cycle that they perpetuate.
So, what are the causes of the increase from 100,000 to, I think you said, 15 million?
Yeah.
Is it simply fashion that hats went out of style?
Yeah. That was sort of part of what saved beavers, I think, originally was that fur was actually replaced by cheap silk from China. That kind of became the hat style, or these silk top hats rather than beaver hats. But I think more recently there's just been a lot of a lot of beaver conservation reintroduction. There are many stories in which many examples of these beaver populations being reintroduced and just taking off. In New York, for example, so the Northeast was completely de-beavered by 1900. There were basically no beavers left in New England or the entire Northeast. And in 1904, some New York State biologists reintroduced around 20 beavers. Some they got from Yellowstone. Some were Canadian beavers. So they dumped 20 beavers into the Adirondacks in upstate New York in 1904. And by 1915, there were 15,000 beavers. So it's just this incredible, dramatic increase, which was caused by, so trapping in that case was banned. We'd also wiped out beaver predators at that point. There were no more wolves left in New York. So that probably helped their populations grow really quickly. And we also eased up on logging around then too. So there was kind of a greater food resource for them. So I think it was a combination of things. It was deliberate reintroduction combined with predator elimination, somewhat ironically. And as you say, I mean, the trapping, trapping just it became less of a way of life, I think. I think the trapping was such a vital early economic industry throughout North America. And gradually as both fashions and social mores changed, as conservation ethics developed, there were more restrictions or limitations on trapping, and that also helped beavers recover.
So I've interviewed a wolf person and also a grizzly bear person, and I asked each one of them, what are the mechanics by which, I hate that word, but what are the means by which these creatures expand their range? And wolves, as you know, will just strike out, and you can have a wolf in Idaho, and all of a sudden you've got one in Northern California because he or she decided to move. And grizzly bears, it ends up, expand their territory pretty slowly, that a daughter will take up range near her mother, And so it might take, you know, five generations to go 100 miles for permanent range. Males can spread around. So where I'm leading with this is how, obviously, if they went from however many up to 15,000 in 11 years, A, they got a lot of babies.
Right.
And B, can you talk about their means of natural re-inhabitation?
Yeah, that's a good question. So so to answer that question, you need to know a little bit about sort of beaver family structure. So a typical beaver colony, a family, is a mating pair, which is, you know, sort of a monogamous, generally monogamous, male and female who mate for life. And then you'll typically get sort of three successive years of offspring all cohabitating in a lodge. So you've got the newborn kits who were born in the spring. Then you've got the one-year-olds, and then you've got the two-year-olds. And sometime during their second year, those two-year-olds will go disperse, basically look out, you know, strike out and look for new territory, just like that juvenile grizzly bear. And you know, in looking for new suitable territory, they can go a really long way. You know, I've heard accounts of beavers traveling over 200 linear stream miles, and you know, and that's probably pretty unusual. I'm sure it's very unusual, but you know, they're capable of dispersing great distances in search of habitat, especially when, you know, the habitat's not great. I mean, in places where the habitat is really good, where there's lots of food, lots of water, you know, not too many predators. You know, they can live in pretty close proximity to each other. You know, you'll get you know, a colony or two every half mile of stream. But you know, in places, especially in the arid West, where you know, the habitat is not as good, they can disperse many miles in search of new terrain. So I think it's, you know, it's really that sort of that colony structure where the, you know, all of the kits, the offspring, all sort of cooperate in the dam and lodge construction until their second year, until they're ready to strike off on their own. That's kind of the mechanism that allows for pretty rapid colonization.
And it sounds to me like you're saying that when they want to find new territory, the preference is to swim up or down stream or up or down river.
Yeah, they definitely, they will occasionally cross overland, but that's definitely not their preference. They definitely stick to the water courses.
Well, that was my next question, is how do they re-inhabit? That must be terribly scary and terribly dangerous for them to inhabit a new watershed. Like, say one watershed is pretty filled up with beavers, and then you have a ridgeline, and then you have another whole river system. That's got to be a really brave little beaver to go walking across the land.
Yeah, it's really definitely true. I mean, especially now, you know, now during that kind of that 2-year-old dispersal season, you know, you see lots of beaver roadkill because we've built roads through all of these wetlands. You know, and that's really a big source of beaver mortality as well. So you're right, it's a very dangerous journey. You know, that's certainly kind of the most perilous time in a beaver's life, I think, is being a dispersing 2-year-old. But they'll actually, you know, what's interesting is as I've been, you know, sort of learning and reading and going out and seeing more and more, these estuary beaver colonies in Washington. I live in Spokane, and last week I was out in kind of the Seattle area, looking at some beavers that had successfully built dams and lodges in sort of tidal salt marshes, which was pretty interesting. And you know, I think that they do more ocean swimming than we give them credit for. You know, that's a method of dispersal too. Instead of having to cross over ridgeline, swim out to the ocean, you know, hang a right and look for the next river mouth. So they're definitely using salt water as well to recolonize some of these river systems.
So maybe listeners won't care, but I lived in Spokane for 10 years. And how are beavers around Spokane and
yeah,
North Idaho?
Yeah, I think that they're. I mean, in the immediate Spokane area, they're doing pretty well. There are definitely lots of. I mean, you can, you know, go down to the Spokane River. I mean, I saw a beaver in the Spokane River last week. They're certainly abundant down there. There's a group here, a nonprofit called the Lands Council, which has done a lot of beaver relocation in the area. and has definitely gotten some colonies up and running in eastern Washington. Northern Idaho is a good question. I'm not quite sure. There's definitely Idaho is kind of a different political climate. There's certainly lots of beaver animosity and still lots of trapping there. I think compared to Washington. So I'm not sure what their status is in Northern Idaho. Probably not great, but around Spokane, I think they're doing pretty okay.
So we've talked about beavers in streams. Do beavers ever live in rivers and not make a dam? They just make a hole in the side of the river and then eat whatever is growing there.
Yes, definitely. And I've seen beavers in the Grand Canyon where they're certainly not building a dam. That's just the Bureau of Reclamation down there. It's the only dam building entity in the canyon. So yeah, the point of the dam is basically to create sufficient water depth so that they're safe. And of course, if that water depth exists without having to dam, then that's their preference. You know, that they certainly build lots of dams, but they don't necessarily want to build dams, right? That's just, you know, that's what they do when they have to. They're very efficient animals. I think that people often talk about, you know, of course, busy as a beaver is such a cliche, but I think that efficient as a beaver in some ways makes more sense. They're not busy for the sake of busyness. They're certainly capable of taking it easy when the water depth is adequate. So yeah, they're, you know, in addition to the kind of the classic beaver lodge, an island lodge that that most people picture when they think of a beaver home. They're certainly very happy to just tunnel into the banks and create a bank burrow, essentially.
I'm going to jump back to a subject when we're talking about the kits leaving home or the 2-year-olds leaving home. Is there how do they maintain? Let's say there's a hole. Let's say a river's pretty full, mm-hmm. or a stream's pretty full, and one of the youngsters is going to leave. Are they pretty territorial in terms of they will kick somebody out as they're walking through? Do they fight with them, or do they just not let them in, or how do they maintain territories?
Yeah, they definitely do fight, and often when you see, you know, if you were to live track an older beaver, you know, you often see him or her covered in scars from battle with other beavers. So yeah, they're definitely territorial, and they will fight if necessary. And usually I think that those, you know, the 2-year-olds, the sub adults are typically smaller. So they, you know, I think they try to avoid picking fights with the occupants of an established territory.
And you said that they live, I think you said they live like 15 years. And will there be, will the failing somebody else coming in, will this family territory more or less be passed down for generations? Do they, can the same family often live the same place for a long time?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question, Derek. I think that certainly you see, you see lots of habitats continuously occupied for many, many years. I lived previously in Northampton, Massachusetts, and there was a beaver colony there at a place called Lake Fitzgerald that I heard had been, and there was kind of this giant lodge, very, very prominent lodge, very sort of active human habituated beavers that you often saw out and about in the evening. I heard from a local scientist that lodge had been continuously occupied since the 1950s. Whether that's the same, you know, whether there's a sort of a direct genetic lineage there, whether that's, you know, it's inhabited by successive generations of offspring, I'm not sure about. I would imagine there's probably some kind of, you know, some that probably happens to some extent. But you know, there's no question that good beaver habitat can be continuously occupied by some beaver or another for decades or even centuries.
So, is their culture passed on? By which I'm asking are there techniques of dam building that can be passed on generation to generation, or is it And I'm not saying this pejorative, or is it purely instinctual?
That's a really good question. So I think that the answer is that it's both, which is probably not a surprising answer. So the experiment that's always cited when people talk about dam building being instinctual is there's this behavioral scientist named Lars Wilson, who in the 1960s performed this experiment where he basically put young beavers that had never that weren't raised by their parents, that had never seen dam building before. He put those young beavers in a concrete walled room with no water in it, and he played the sound of running water through a speaker in the floor, and gave the beavers sticks, and the beavers immediately dammed the speaker that was playing the sound of running water in this concrete room. So that's that kind of indicates that yes, certainly the dam building behavior is deeply hardwired in beavers, and
I just have to mention that's pretty sadistic.
It's very, very cruel. Yeah, no, it wasn't a kind experiment, but it was a sort of illuminating one.
Right.
So that's the experiment that people often cite when they say, well, clearly these animals, they're just sort of automatons. They're not. There's no learning really happening here. But counter to that. I highly recommend a book called Lily Pond by a naturalist named Hope Ryden, who observed beavers for many years, and which she documented very clearly, that has also been observed by many other beaver scientists, is there's so much, that the dam and lodge building is an incredibly collaborative, interactive exercise within the beaver colony, and that young beavers, the kits, are quite clearly following their parents, imitating their parents, learning techniques of dam and lodge construction and of food acquisition, of tree felling. They're very complex behaviors, and it's clear to anybody who's ever observed beavers closely that the kits are gaining a lot from their couple of years in the company of their parents. So I kind of think about it like language, maybe, in humans or other species too. Of course, the desire to speak is really innate in us. But you don't actually learn English unless you spend a lot of time in the company of other English speakers. I think that beavers are similar. Yes, clearly there's a deeply hardwired impulse to dam, but the kind of the finer points of that construction is acquired through the transmission of intergenerational knowledge.
So we have about 10 minutes left, and this isn't the official wind down question yet,
okay,
but a sort of starting to wind down question. I'm sure you've seen that video of what happened when wolves re-inhabited Yellowstone and how there was this cascading effect of ecological enhancement. They drove the elk out of the riparian zones, which allowed the trees to come back, which allowed the trout to come back, which also allowed the songbirds to come back. It's like everybody, the elk aren't quite so happy, but everybody else is very happy.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you walk us through a 10 to 20 to 30 year period of a stream that's been hammered and a couple of beavers walk in, and then tell us about who, and we can tell the same story about prairie dogs, of course, with burrowing owls and rattlesnakes, but so tell us what happens and how the land and water and the beings, plants and animals, come alive.
Yeah, and
walk us through that process.
Sure. I should say first that I'm glad you brought up the Yellowstone example because to me, I mean Yellowstone is actually, yes, it's an amazing wolf story, but it's also an amazing beaver story. That Yellowstone was once an incredible, especially the northern range where a lot of this sort of the trophic cascade is happening. I mean, that was once an incredible complex of beaver ponds and wetlands. That was such a lush spectacular place. And when predators were eliminated and elk kind of ran wild and ate all of that streamside willow and aspen and cottonwood, you know, beavers really collapsed in the park. And, you know, and now partly because wolves are returning and, you know, and thinning those elk herds a little bit, you know, beavers have been somewhat able to reestablish in the northern part of the park and are recreating some of that really wet, lush habitat. So to me, you know, I think that the Yellowstone story is an amazing story because it sort of indicates how important beavers and wolves together are, right? I mean, you need beavers to create this wonderful pond and wetland habitat, and you need, in many cases, you need wolves or other predators to create the conditions in which beavers can return. So it's sort of, you've kind of got two keystone species interacting in a really interesting way. Anyway, so to return to your original question, I mean, what happens when beavers move in? Well, I mean, so it's what's really cool about beavers to me is this amazing sort of cycle that happens, you know, where initially they build this dam, of course, and they create this big deep pond. And you know, the first beneficiaries there are fish. That's fantastic, especially rearing habitat for young salmon, trout, other species. As the water spreads out and the water tables rise, you know, you'll get trees that die kind of around the periphery of the beaver pond, and those turn into snags, which turn into fantastic habitat for woodpeckers, you know, who create holes that are then occupied by fishers and flying squirrels and other creatures. Gradually over time, what happens is that, you know, those beaver ponds tend to fill in.
Wait.
Yeah.
Can you bring insects in too, please?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Of course. I mean, we know that these beaver ponds are fantastic habitat for aquatic insects as well, and that, you know, it's been shown by scientists repeatedly, many times, that, you know, you get amazing just production, and you know, and the reason for that, of course, is that you're broadening the pond. Beavers are removing these trees, so they're opening up the canopy. So you're getting all of this sunlight hitting the surface of the pond, which leads to, you know, this huge growth in primary production, right? All of this photosynthesis happening now because you've permitted light to strike the pond, and you're producing lots of aquatic vegetation, and that, you know, and that leads to this boom in aquatic insects, which also, you know, feeds songbirds. You know, I mean, beaver ponds are fantastic places for songbirds to inhabit because they're these really wonderful kind of edge habitats where you can, you know, you can perch in a pond side tree and fly out into the middle of the pond to snatch a mayfly or what have you. They're great bat habitat for the same reason. Actually, beavers are, you know, people don't really think about the beaver bat connection, but bats do really well around beaver ponds. So I'm glad you brought up the insects because that's a kind of a critical link in the chain. So what happens gradually over time is either the beavers will exhaust their food supply and move on, or the pond will fill in with sediment, and gradually over time, you know, the pond, either the dam will breach or the pond will just sort of fill in. And when that happens, you know, you get the kind of the growth of this entirely new plant community, you know, these lots of sedges, for example, that will grow in these kind of wet meadows that replace the open water from the initial pond. And when that happens, you know, that becomes fantastic foraging sites for ungulates, you know, for elk, deer, moose, you know, black bears show up to eat, you know, all of the plants that are, you know, the berries and the roots that are, you know, sort of taking hold in these wet meadows. So that's, you know, that's a kind of a completely different kind of habitat, but a really important one. And of course, you know, those wet meadows are really vital for amphibians as well. You know, you've got, I mean, sometimes it can be hard for tadpoles and frog eggs to survive in a fish occupied beaver pond, but you know, as those ponds fill in and become less fish habitat, they become really great amphibian habitat. So there's kind of this fantastic cycle that happens as the initial beaver pond becomes a wetland and a wet meadow, and then gradually the forest canopy closes in again, and you know, conditions are sort of right for the next beaver family to arrive. You know, and that process can, you know, it can take years, or it can take decades or centuries. But I think that's one of the really amazing things about beaver-occupied sites is just the way that they kind of transition from one habitat state to another over the course of very long time periods.
So I have two wind-down questions. One of them is, what do you want people to take away from your book and from this interview? Your book is fantastic, by the way, again, called Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. Fantastic book. And second is, if people are already in love with beavers, what can they do to help them?
Yeah, good question. So I think first, you know, I think that to me the big message of the book is humility. You know, I think that obviously we humans are such fanatical micromanagers of nature. We're so enamored of our kind of our godlike engineering prowess, you know, and to me, you know, the lesson that beavers teach us is that, you know, there are other species out there that are not only capable of engineering, but they do it in a way that is so much more beneficial for other life than the way that we do it. You know, you said before that you know, earlier you compared human-built concrete dams and, you know, the fact that they're huge anadromous fish barriers with, you know, with beaver dams, which are permeable to anadromous fish, you know, so we're sort of doing the same thing, yet we have vastly different impacts on the environment. So to me, I mean, one of my favorite quotes from the book is I met this kind of an engineer and beaverologist named Joe Wheaton down in Utah, and Joe's mantra is, let the rodent do the work, you know, sort of instead of us, again, you know, fanatically micromanaging nature, you know, we can encourage this rodent, which is capable of storing water, improving water quality, creating habitat for other creatures, you know, providing fire breaks that, you know, dampening the landscape against wildfire, slowing down floods. You know, beavers provide all of these incredibly valuable services that we spend billions of dollars trying to replicate. And of course, they, you know, they do it ingeniously and for free and in a way that's beneficial to other life rather than inimical to it. So to me, the lesson is, let the rodent do the work. Let's be humble and in the face of other species. As for what individuals can do for beavers, well, I mean, I think that, you know, first of all, you know, if you live in a place that has beavers, you know, so the, you know, for all of my love of beavers, I'm not naive about how challenging beavers can be to coexist with, right? I mean, you know, yes, you're kind of rural Western folks, you know, complain that they cut down trees, you know, they flood people's property, they wash out roads when they clog up culverts, you know, they dam in irrigation ditches, you know, they do all of this stuff that can be, you know, that can be at times tricky to coexist with. But you know, there are lots of techniques for coexistence. You know, one of the solutions that I highlight in the book is this thing called a flow device, which is basically, you know, you often hear it called a beaver deceiver, and it's basically this pipe and fence system that you can install that kind of regulates the height of the beaver pond. So you can say, okay, you know, I like having these beavers here, I appreciate all the good they do, but, you know, I don't want my property underwater. And you can install one of these flow device contraptions to basically manage the problem non-lethally. So I think there are lots of opportunities to solve these beaver-human conflicts in a way that's beneficial for both parties. So if you live in a town where beavers clogging culverts and flooding roads is an issue, you know, talk to your town roads department or the state DOT or the town manager or whoever the person who controls infrastructure in your town is, about looking into these flow devices or beaver deceivers, you know, these contraptions that can kind of manage those problems without having to resort to trapping. So that's what I would say. And, you know, there's a really great nonprofit out there called the Beaver Institute, which is run by a guy named Mike Callahan, who's kind of one of the leading champions of beaver coexistence. And that has lots of resources on it about, you know, how you can install these things and live harmoniously with these really extraordinary animals.
Well, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Ben Goldfarb. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.